Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Edition of the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show. This is Brian Diaz. I am happy to be here with you on a Thursday. Happy Thursday, everybody. We are in the home stretch coming up here on the weekend. That's a good thing, I think. I know it's a good thing. Makes me pretty happy. Tomorrow's Friday. That's a good thing, too. And I'm happy about that. I mean, I think it's just kind of a happy thing all the way around here on Thursday here on the NOLA Drinks edition of the show. Got a good show coming up for you today. We'll be joined by Leora Pearl Madden of Pearl Wine Company. About the second half an hour here of the show, we're going to talk a little bit about Pinot Noir from Willamette Valley. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about champagne. Two of my favorite things. I mean, how can you go wrong? Pinot Noir from Willamette and champagne. So that should be fun, educational, informative, as it always is with Leora. Also, then in the second hour, we're going to do our At the Bar segment, which is a semi-regular feature that we do. And I'm pleased to welcome two very talented bartenders into the show. Conrad Cantor, who is the co-proprietor, of El Libre, which is a very cool Cuban cafe. They do food and they do classic Cuban cocktails right there on Dumaine, where it dead ends at Decatur in the quarter. Conrad is a wealth of knowledge on Cuban drinks, rum, and these things. In addition, I'll be joined by Alex Anderson, and she similarly is an expert in this realm of the cocktail world. She is a bartender at Cane and Table, also in the quarter, which is a little ways down on Decatur. I want to say the 1100 block of Decatur, if I'm not mistaken, by where Margaritaville used to be, across the street from the new B.B. King's Blues Club. More importantly, next door to Coop's. Let's put it that way. If you're from here, you know what I'm talking about. And Alex is also a fine, fine bartender. And we're going to talk, because of the commonality here, we're going to talk a little bit about tiki drinks. We're going to talk about proto tiki drinks. We're going to talk about rum and stuff like that. So that should be pretty fun. And it's also Alex's birthday, from what I understand. So we are pleased to celebrate her birthday here on the show. Should be an interesting conversation. As I said, that'll be in the second hour with our At the Bar segment. Should be a lot of fun. Next week's show, when I am in, and I will actually be in, I'll mention, if you're listening to the show yesterday, I sat in with Tim on the Dine, Wine, and Spirit show, his show during this time, Monday through Wednesday and on Fridays. And Tim is out of town, as he often is, so I'll be filling in for my buddy tomorrow, Friday, and also on Monday. And then Tim will be back in on Tuesday. But here on the NOLA Drinks show on Thursday of next week, I'll be welcoming. We're still working that one out a little bit, but I'm excited. We're starting to do a regular feature here on the show where we talk to a local musician here from Southeast Louisiana, typically. And not only do we talk about the music that they perform and their gigs and all that kind of stuff, but we talk about their connection to food and drink in the region, how they grew up, what their connection, what their love is, what their passion is. Of course, we know that in a lot of music here in New Orleans, things like food and drink are referenced over and over and over again in song lyrics and these sorts of things. So next week, I will be joined by Roddy Romero, who is the leader of the band Roddy Romero and the Hub City All-Stars, which is a terrific band. They were Grammy nominated. They're out of Lafayette, and they're got a great, they're all cooks, all the guys in the band. They're very connected to farm to table stuff, some local charities that do food and that sort of consideration in Acadiana. So I'm really looking forward to chatting with Roddy, and then he'll be performing a week from Saturday at Pontchartrain Vineyards as part of their Jazz and the Vine series up over there on the North Shore in Bush. So that should be a lot of fun. Tune into that. It's always great to talk to musicians about food and drink and their music. Can't go wrong there. Tonight, friends, over at Armstrong Park, Jazz in the Park is continuing. I think we've got three more to go. Yes, three more to go. That kicks off at 4 o'clock with a DJ, but I'm hoping that you're going to be listening to the show until 5 o'clock. That's when the music starts. So that's when you should head over there. And it's the opening band is Mystic, and then the headlining band is Mike Soulman Baptiste. If you've never seen Mike Soulman Baptiste, I suggest that you check it out. Mike is a fantastic performer. He does great R&B stuff, a lot of New Orleans R&B and some other things. And man, the guy puts on a show. It's a fantastic crack group of musicians and other things. He's a great performer. That should be really fun. That goes until, I think, 8:30. And again, I think the live music kicks off at 5 right there. It's free right at Armstrong Park, right there on Rampart. Streetcars open. I say that all the time, but it looks great. It's all a lot of fun, a lot of good establishments over there. Go check out our friends at Bar Tonique or Black Penny or Mo Bar. Grab yourself a drink, grab yourself a bite, head over to Armstrong Park. They do have food trucks there, I believe, food vendors, artisans, all that good stuff. So that should be pretty fun. Check that on out. Also, coming up tonight, if you are interested, there is a fundraiser, and this is for the Big Class, and it's it's called Big Class, and it's a youth writing nonprofit, and it's I believe, support both literacy and then also writing skills, creative writing, these sorts of things. And it's taking place at the Felicity Church, and it starts at 6 o'clock. That's actually if you're a patron of the organization. Opens up for the rest of us at 7 o'clock, and they have a cocktail competition that is loosely based on the drink, A Dark and Stormy. They're calling it A Dark and Stormy Night, so it's really more of a kind of a nod to Halloween, of course, as we're talking about here. But a lot of people, from what I understand, are going to take that one step further and base that on the Dark and Stormy, which is, of course, a traditional Bermudan drink that really involves rums, basically made with Gosling's rum, and then ginger beer. But people aren't beholden to using rum per se, or Gosling's rum, or even ginger beer. I've heard of a couple interesting spins coming out tonight with that. But tickets are 2 tickets for $80. Not too bad. An individual ticket, I think, is a little bit less, something like that. If you just go look for classy.org, which is the name of the organization, classy.org, find out more about that. So there's a dance party, cocktail competition. I think there's some small nibbles, stuff like that. Go check that out. That sounds like a worthy cause. Also coming up over the weekend, sadly, I learned that Ed Harrison, who is the brother of Big Chief Donald Harrison Sr., who passed away a number of years ago, also passed away. So there will be a second line for him on Saturday. I was trying to track down the details. Maybe, Anthony, we can track down the details of the second line for Ed Harrison. But that'll be a traditional Mardi Gras Indian second line and service that's, it's part of the culture. And as I was listening to Action Jackson there on WWOZ earlier today, who brings the news about second lines and all the stuff going on, talking about he kept saying to himself, or saying to us, that he must see, and then he kept correcting himself. Yes, it's a sad thing, and it is a sad thing, but how we celebrate this stuff here in New Orleans is interesting. It's part of the healing process. Go out there, make it a little bit more positive. Like he said, it'll be a cultural experience, as it should be. That's Saturday. We'll try and get those details. Then also on Sunday is we're in the season, folks. We're in second line season, and we're in all kinds of stuff going on. So now all the way through, really, Jazz Fest and even slightly beyond, it's something every weekend. There's also a second line on Sunday, October 23rd, from 2 to 6, and that is the Black Men of Labor Second Line Parade, which is that's a real cool one that's gone on for a number of years. That's going to start at Sweet Lorraine's Jazz Club, which is there on St. Claude, and 1931 St. Claude, to be specific. It's a good route. That's also just another really fun second line to go check out. And then you get a chance to go check out a lot of the establishments up in that direction. A lot of good places to go eat and drink there on St. Claude. And then I think it wraps up. No, it disbands back over at Sweet Lorraine's Jazz Club. The one that I was talking about before with Ed Harrison, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is going to start at the Mother-in-Law Lounge, which is now owned by the great Kermit Ruffins. Of course, that was... it's right there. And Kermit will host, I think, the party after. That's where it will disband as well. So check that out. We'll get you that information. I'm sorry, I don't have that in front of me now. So second lines, folks, we got the good fundraiser tonight. We got Jazz in the Park and Armstrong Park, all kinds of good stuff. Folks, stay tuned to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition here on WGSO 990 AM. This is Brian. I'm going to come back with a little bit of wine news, talking about Harvest 2016 after the break.
And now when the saints go marching in.
Breakfast is new to the menu at Dickie Brennan's Tableau. Stop by for Tableau's signature Eggs Benedict or order their famous bread pudding Pan Perdue. Tableau now offers brass brunch on Saturdays and Sundays beginning at 10 a.m. Listen to the rhythmic sounds of a New Orleans-style brass band while enjoying a wonderful brunch in the heart of the French Quarter overlooking historic Jackson Square. For menus, reservations, and more, visit TableauFrenchQuarter.com or call 504-934-3463. Tableau is located at 616 St. Peter Street.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz, happy to be here with you on a Thursday. Good stuff. We are still working on that information about the Ed Harrison second line, if you're interested in attending that on Saturday. I do know that it does start at the Mother-in-Law Lounge, owned there by Kermit Ruffins, originally started, of course, by the late, great Ernie Cato. And that is on St. Claude. And Anthony is diligently looking to find you that information. I'm sure you could contact the Mother-in-Law Lounge, give them a call, and find out exactly what time it is. Hopefully we can find it. And if not, then that's how you can go about it. And of course, as always, I'll work to dig that up. If we can't find it during the broadcast, you can go check us out on NOLA Drinks, which is noladrinks.com, and on all the social media, as I like to say, and really not all, but the three or four kind of biggies. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, probably a couple others. And if you go just search for NOLA Drinks there on Facebook, I'll post that up if we don't get it during the broadcast of where you can find that once we dig up the information. I do encourage you to go check that out. That's a great way to interact with NOLA Drinks and here on the show. I'm happy to answer questions, take ideas for stories, get your input. So go like the Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We share a lot of different stuff there on Pinterest, which is always a lot of fun. And also, if you're interested, if you're listening to the show now, but like to listen to the show on your own terms, at your own time and on your own schedule, you can go to iTunes, you can go to Google Play Music, and you can go to TuneIn Radio, search for NOLA Drinks, and you will find the podcast. So I'd be very happy to have you subscribe to that and download it, of course, and listen to it at your leisure. Aside from the broadcast of the show itself, every Thursday, 3 to 5 here on the radio, you're welcome to, you know, I put the whole broadcast up. And then what I also do is the different other features that support things that we do. So our feature cocktail videos, sometimes a couple weeks removed, if there was an interesting segment or two that we ran on the show, those will be edited down commercial free that you can listen to just those two segments. All kinds of other stuff that just sort of feed into the broadcast and just separate stuff that we do. The feature cocktails are a lot of fun. Watch a local bartender make a drink, sometimes famous, sometimes their own creation. And it's a good way. Hey, you can learn how to make it there at your home bar. And that stuff's available on our YouTube channel. But you'll find that on our website, noladrinks.com. And again, check out the podcast, please. I'd really appreciate that. Let's turn to a little bit of wine news, since we do talk a lot about wine here on the show. Anthony, I'm going to start with the bad news. Are you okay? Anthony's here working the board, as he always is. He's giving me the nod. We're going to start with the bad news, and then we're going to come with the good news. So here's the bad news. Bad news is that global wine production estimated has fallen 5%, all chalked up due to climatic events. So across the board, globally, and this has mostly been focused on the Southern Hemisphere, this is according to the International Organization of Vine and Wine, that this is actually one of the lowest production years in the past two decades. 5% maybe doesn't sound like a lot, folks, but given the overall production demand, all of that kind of stuff, 5% is almost really seismic. The article does go on. This is from The Guardian in the UK, a newspaper out of London, that consumer demand is still expected to be met so we can all rest a little easier. Don't worry, there's going to be wine available for sale and you can get it. Wouldn't surprise me if we see prices of certain things go up just a touch. As I mentioned, a lot of the southern hemisphere, really, and in particular Chile and Argentina, were probably the most affected by this. And as we know, in this market, a lot of those wines are some of, you know, nice wines at a nice price. So, you know, if these things maybe go up 50 cents or a dollar, it's not going to kill you, because they started out at 12 bucks or 13 bucks a bottle, give or take a few bucks. But, you know, down again, and actually a pretty considerable amount, 35% loss or down from average yields in Argentina, and 21% in Chile, and also inclusive of this, South Africa, of course, being in the southern hemisphere. And on the other part of the world, in the eastern hemisphere, when we cut up the globe that way, they were down 19%. Italy still produced the most wine in 2016, which is typically the case, followed by France, Spain, the U.S., Australia, and China. France did remain in the top three, even though their production suffered 12%, which is 41.9 million hectoliters. That is a lot of wine, folks. They're still number three. It's interesting to see that China is number five in the rank of producers. They grow a lot of wine in China, folks. It's something that is sort of an ongoing thing. They buy a lot of wine in China. I also read earlier in the day today that China has become the largest export market for Australian wines, but that is a side note. So production, you know, was down. And actually, let's see, Australia increased production by 5%, and New Zealand enjoyed a 35% rise in production, which, that's considerable. They actually nearly reached their record that they set in 2014, so they've had some banner years recently. Again, this was all due to climatic episodes one way or the other. Warming temperatures are to be blamed, really, for a lot of this. We've talked about this for a number of years, but things with one degree, I find this very interesting, with 1 degree centigrade of temperature raise, that is accelerated harvest by an average of 6 to 7 days. It's also affecting latitudinally where wines are grown and how they're able to be grown. So we're talking about, for example, a threat to Pinot Noir being grown in the sensitive environment and the sensitive grape that it is in Burgundy. We're starting to see more things, for example, being grown, a lot of sparkling wine varietals being grown in the southern UK. And this is due in part or large part to climate change, frankly. Let's turn to some of the good news. All right, Anthony, we're going good news. So the production and harvest in California has generally looked pretty good. And people were a little bit worried about all the rains that just came in over the weekend. And frankly, due to the drought, these rains are welcome on a whole. But for the most part, all the reports that I've been reading in the past couple days, that rain came, it dumped a good amount of rain. Not a huge amount of rain in Northern California, but a good amount. But it came and it went and it dried out. The good news, folks, is that a lot of people were, they were already largely done, or in some, many, many cases, actually all done with harvest. So most of the stuff was off. What we also get, too, is a lot of the late harvested grapes, a lot of our Bordeaux varietals, Cabernet Sauvignon, Petit Verdot, Merlot, some of these guys, they tend to be a little more loose cluster. So you get the rain, it comes in, it actually, if it warms up and dries out pretty quick, those grapes have thick skins. So we're looking pretty good. Everybody is raving about the quality. It does look like the yields are going to be about 10 to 15% down from average, although the historical average has been about 3.9 million tons in recent years. Seems to be pretty close to that mark, but recent years, you know, past few years, it's going to be down about 10 or 15%, but nobody's really complaining about the quality. And actually, really, it was looking like it was going to be a very fast and very compressed harvest, meaning that the early stuff like the Pinot Noir and the Chardonnay typically come in right out of the gate. And then the stuff that usually wraps up harvest, like the Merlot and the Cabernet Sauvignon, they were looking like they were all going to come in a very compressed fashion. This can create problems, friends, in the cellar, because there's just not tank space as people are pressing and crushing, putting stuff in tanks, letting stuff ferment, letting stuff sit on the skins before they can actually put it in the barrel. But there was a little bit of a cooling that actually took place in September and also in October, little spikes, or I should say valleys or troughs here and there in the temperature, that kind of slowed some things down. So it spread things out a little bit more than what was expected, and that's welcome news. Almost every single thing, even though the yields are going to be down about 10 to 15%, that I keep hearing and reading, and even from some of my friends out there in the wine businesses, everybody's raving about the quality. Now, of course, in California, 2012, 2013, and 2014 were tremendous years. Last year was actually a pretty good year, too, in 15, but people are talking about 16 maybe being in that sort of vaunted vintage consideration, like 12, 13, 14, you know, maybe, hey, it might even look like 2007, which is, you know, one of the best ones that we've seen in a couple decades out there in California. So overall, pretty good news. You know, aside from the global production being down about 5%, we have to worry about the long-term issues connected to climate change, because that is a true, real, present clear threat to wine production. Grapes are incredibly sensitive, folks, to the mildest change in the average changes in climate and in the terroir. And that's really what we're talking about here. But this year, 2016, looks pretty good. So there's some good news for you. Folks, we are going to take the bottom of the hour break here on the Noel Drinks Show. This is Brian Diaz. Happy to be here with you. When we return from the break, we are going to be joined by Leora Pearl Madden, talking a little bit about Pinot Noir from Oregon and a little bit about champagne. So come on back.
Market is a place where history is made fresh daily. From the historic Upper Pontalba building on Jackson Square to the ever-evolving Farmers Market, our six-block district celebrates New Orleans food, music, and culture through events, festivals, walking tours, health and fitness classes, and also children's workshops at the New Orleans Jazz Park. Visit our calendar of events at www.frenchmarket.org. The French Market. Making history fun since 1791.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Breakfast is new to the menu at Dickie Brennan's Tableau. Stop by for Tableau's signature Eggs Benedict or order their famous bread pudding Pan Perdue. Tableau now offers brass brunch on Saturdays and Sundays beginning at 10 a.m. Listen to the rhythmic sounds of a New Orleans-style brass band while enjoying a wonderful brunch in the heart of the French Quarter overlooking historic Jackson Square. For menus, reservations, and more, visit TableauFrenchQuarter.com or call 504-934-3463. Tableau is located at 616 St. Peter Street.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. It's football and festival season, and there's no better way to enjoy Sazerac Rye than in a pothole cocktail. Just fill up a glass with ice and your favorite root beer, and add 2 ounces of Sazerac Rye for a truly tasty toddy. Named after the city's most iconic of inconveniences, the pothole is proof that New Orleans never takes itself too seriously. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
This is Christopher Icaza, general manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucaray. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's Grand Dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon Dining Room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Well, after I'm through this bottle of wine, I'm gonna take you out, girl, and spend some time.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show. NOLA Drinks Edition. That's what this is here on WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. Little Eric Lindell, all alone for you. That's from the Pictures with Music album, man. He's a great musician. Go check him out. Speaking of great, I am happy to be joined by my pal, Leora Madden, over there at Pearl Wine Company. Leora, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I am doing great. Thanks for asking. It's a nice Thursday afternoon. We're going to be talking about rum a little later on in the show. So, yeah, I know you like that stuff. You're not all about wine, Leora. I know that.
No, I'm not. I don't discriminate. I drink all the things.
Yeah, you know, this is a complete tangent from what we were talking about, but it makes me chuckle. Years ago, I was at a baseball game visiting friends that I grew up with in California, and I was at the game. It was the end of the game. I had a glass of wine in my hand, and one of my buddies took a picture of me drinking wine at a ball game and put it up on Facebook, and it generated all these comments that people were concerned that I was drinking wine at a baseball game, like, you know, what kind of hoity-toity guy am I? And then my friend responded, "Don't worry, we already had rum in the parking lot. I went through three beers and I'm now drinking wine." So as he said, I covered all three of my major booze groups, sort of like a square meal, you know?
You know what I say? Like a boss.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Exactly. You know, I mean, I'm an equal opportunity drinker, Leora. There's no, I'm not, you know, yeah. So there you go.
Yep.
And I know
I'm absolutely with you.
I know you are. Because we've kind of covered that gamut together. I know. So for sure.
Yeah, we have quite a few times, actually.
Indeed. So how are things over there at Pearl Wine Company?
They're great. The farmer's market is getting running, and we're getting ready for our tasting with Brooks Pinot Noir. And things are bustling.
Yeah, well, and that's actually what we were. Nice segue. That's what we were meant to talk about here in this segment with you. I was talking about this earlier in the show. We're going to talk. You're doing a tasting tonight with featuring Pinot Noir from the Willamette Valley there in Oregon, and we were going to talk a little bit about Pinot Noir in Oregon.
Okay, let's talk.
Let's talk about it. So, you know, I was actually just looking at the map of the Willamette Valley. And it's interesting because there are now over 500 wineries. And one of the things that I hadn't really looked at in quite a while is, you know, most of them are kind of concentrated in that area, just south and basically south of Portland. The valley runs basically north-south. But there's a lot of stuff creeping, you know, all the way down to Eugene. And there's a growing number of wineries at the bottom of the valley.
Yeah, it's really incredible how quickly it has grown over the years. And by over the years, I mean, you know, since the late 70s, when the first, you know, vines were planted, or mid-70s, we could say, when the first vines were planted by Erie. And, you know, so many incredible stories, I think, have come out of Oregon in terms of, you know, winemakers and owners and people who are just genuinely passionate about what they do and, you know, specifically the Pinot grape, whether that's Pinot Gris or Pinot Noir. There are some really amazing things happening now that those vines have started to mature.
Yeah, and you know, Leora, and tell me if you agree with this. I get the sense, and I've been familiar with the region for a number of years, but not intimately so. I never worked there specifically or anything like that. So many wine regions, they start out in the New World, I should say. They start out doing what I always say this, what they think they're supposed to do, and as opposed to what they should do. So meaning that, you know, they try and plant Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay, for example, and then it takes them 15 years or 10 years or 5 years to realize that that doesn't work. It doesn't grow well. It doesn't perform well where they are. In the case of Willamette, I get the sense that people figured it out pretty quickly. They knew it was a cooler environment. So the grapes that you mentioned, Pinot Grigio, Pinot Gris, Pinot Noir, it needs that cooling climate, right? But did you get that? I kind of figured they found their footing kind of early.
I think they did too. And it's quite an anomaly for domestic wines here in the U.S., as you know. And it's been one of the, you know, heralds of the region, I think, that they were able to figure that out very quickly. And here's why I think they were able to, Brian, and I hope I'm not offending anyone in other parts of the U.S., because that's certainly not my intent.
But I do it every day. It's okay.
But I think some of the pioneers in Oregon, they weren't there to grow church wine. They weren't there to, you know, just start something back up again post-prohibition. They were there to truly farm and truly start something of value. And I think that that foundation has catapulted them and launched them into a, you know, quicker success time, if you will, than some of the other regions in the U.S.
I think that's a great point, Leora. And I think there is, to a certain degree, maybe an analog here to, in part, in certain parts of the far north of the North Coast, like we're talking about Mendocino in California, where really, you know, you had the situation, there was a so-called back to the land movement in the late 60s and really early 70s when you had, frankly, a lot of disillusioned hippies that moved out of San Francisco and started co-op, you know, started co-op farms. That's where a lot of the authors went, a lot of the musicians went coming out of the late 60s. And, you know, and it was this kind of thing where you know, you grew tomatoes and you traded your tomatoes for somebody who knew how to do roofing. And a lot of the wine, I mean, yes, there was a traditional or an older guard that had been planting before, people that came from Europe and done things. But in some of these areas like Mendocino, and I think Willamette's the case too, where you had people that were kind of more coming from that movement, sort of new traditionalists, if you will. And I think you're 100% right. It was not, they were not beholden by the dogma. It was, you know, let's just do something that works.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was about, it was about the winemaking, and they were fortunate to come into winemaking at a time where some things had already developed, and we had some knowledge, we had some education, and so the mistakes and, you know, successes of California were to the benefit of Oregon making a very quick, you know, success of what they were trying to do,
right,
frankly.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And as we mentioned, it's basically a cooler climate, and that's what,
yep,
Pinot likes, cool, and Pinot doesn't like too hot. It's a thinner skinned grape. Pinot Grigio is more or less the same thing. And that whole valley, let's talk a little bit about the terroir there. Aside from the cooling climate,
yeah,
what's making that click with this family of grapes?
Volcanic, mm-hmm, rock, number one. Like you said, the cooler climate. And let's talk about Willamette. I mean, you know, there's so many sub-appellations, but you don't have as much wind and temperature change and temperature variation. And that mountain range, those valleys are really protecting the grapes from the Pacific, because a lot of them are eastern facing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't get the harshness of the Pacific coast that the California regions do on many occasions.
Yeah, that.
Not all, but some.
Yeah, exactly. And that north-south orientation of the valley is providing that protection. And when you start to get up, as you're saying, when you start to get up that far into the northwest of the United States, the Pacific is a beast. It really is there.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. And if you haven't been on the Pacific from, let's say, you know, San Diego to Seattle, it's hard to understand that climate and that climate change. But imagine, if you will, you know, anything from an irrigated desert all the way to, you know, a incredibly lush and vegetal
mountainous.
Mountainous forest, and then you have the redwoods in between. So it really is an absolute change in terroir in just a matter of 1,000 miles.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. It really makes for a big difference. And so, you know, we do a lot of Pinot Noir here at Pearl, and we have a section dedicated to Oregon and a section dedicated to California. And people definitely know the difference more now, mm-hmm. I think, than they did before. And they understand, the similarities in the latitude, frankly, of Burgundy to Oregon and how that cooler climate affects Pinot Noir. And they truly do understand how fickle the grape is, but also how versatile it is, which makes it so amazing.
Absolutely. And, you know, as I've said to you on numerous occasions, to me, and everybody's different, it is a delicate grape. Its presentation and it's the process in which to make it needs to also be somewhat delicate. It's fickle, I'll use your word, which is a very good word. People, if you overdo the Pinot Noir grape, you basically run the grape over. So if the alcohol is too high, if it's too ripe, it doesn't have good enough acidity, which that cooling weather helps bring up. If you put too much oak on it, all this kind of stuff, you've done the grape a disservice. And one of the things that I always like is I like, you know, a bit of mild red fruit, you know, sort of those red berry notes, but mild. And then I always like to have a bit of minerality shine through. It's like a good Burgundy, a good coastal California, a good Willamette, Oregon Pinot is going to have that very almost kind of flinty minerality to it. And that's something personally that I look for.
Well, and admittedly, Brian, I favor more of the Santa Maria Valley, the Santa Barbara area, the San Ynez Pinot Noirs. And mm-hmm. I think that for people who are looking for something kind of in between, say, you know, Northern Coast, Sonoma, Napa, that area, something in between that and Oregon, I think they're really going to find that Central Coast area, that Santa Maria Valley, is that in between. And it is something to be beholden. It's something that should not be passed up. And what I've been able to do, because I learned wine on the Central Coast primarily, is carry wine, Pinot Noir, of course, from that area and put them next to Sonoma. And over time, I've been able to grow that selection from the Central Coast because people taste it, they trust me, they see it, and then they say, oh, wow, you know, this is pretty amazing. And so now I have a lot more people who are going to Central Coast and Oregon at the same time, depending on what their mood is.
Yep.
And that's so great to see.
Absolutely. And these are two, in the New World and in the United States, these are basically, these are the two places from which to get Pinot, folks. I mean, let's be honest here.
Absolutely.
Well, Leora,
without a doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. Do me a favor, Leora, stick around through the break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about bubbles. How's that sound?
That sounds fabulous.
Awesome, folks. Coming back to NOLA Drinks. We're joined by Leora Madden of Pearl Wine Company. We're talking about Pinot Noir. Now we're going to talk a little bit about champagne and the world of bubbles. A little rebirth. Come on back.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Springtime in New Orleans is beckoning us back on our front porches, favorite patio bars and restaurants.
Dickie Brennan's Tableau offers some of the best outdoor dining in the French Quarter. Soak in the beautiful weather on the balcony overlooking Jackson Square or by the whispering fountain in the cozy courtyard. Tableau also offers an amazing happy hour from 2 to 6 p.m. every day of the week, offering half-price beer and wine on tap, $5 classic cocktails, and discounted small plates. For menus, reservations, and more, visit TableauFrenchQuarter.com. Tableau is located at 616 St. Peter Street.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petite Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
I'm a fool to care.
When you try. All right, everybody. Welcome back to NOLA Drinks here on WTSO 990 AM New Orleans. This is Brian Diaz. Happy to be here with you. We're chatting with Laura Mann of Pearl Wine Company. Laura, let's talk bubbles. How do you feel about that?
I will allow it.
No, you're making it sound like it's a true stretch, and I'm not buying it. I am absolutely not buying it. I know better. I know. It's. I mean, I probably even have like photographic evidence that I know better.
Yeah, right.
Cool. So you're doing. So we'll circle back on the tastings tonight and on Friday there at Pearl. But yeah. The one tomorrow night is on. Is it champagne specific? Or are we talking about the broader world of sparkling here?
Champagne specific to the method.
Okay.
So the broader world of sparkling, but those producers who use the champagne method who may not necessarily be in champagne, because as we know and some people are learning over time is that, you know, quote unquote, if it's not from champagne, it's not real champagne. But of course, we know it as the famous region to create that method of two fermentations in the bottle that creates those beautiful bubbles.
Yeah, and so thank you for saying that, because what we're talking about, people I think get confused sometimes these days due to various legal wranglings. If it's called champagne or is champagne, then it has to come from the region in France known as Champagne. Anything else is part of the broader family, of which technically champagne is as well, which is sparkling wine. So that might be Cava from Spain, Prosecco from Italy, any of the various sparkling varietals or wines that we get from anywhere else in the New World. But then what we're talking about here, as you just said, is in French, it's the méthode champenoise, the champagne method. And I'll have you reiterate what that is. And then we're also seeing, and we were talking about this, I was a guest on Tim's show yesterday on the Dine, Wine, and Spirit show, and we were talking about how people, Leora, are starting to label bottles more méthode traditionnelle as opposed to champenoise. Are you seeing more of that?
We are seeing more of that across the board, particularly with the New World. Now, of course, those in France outside of Champagne who use that method are going to be under the name of Cremant. But we are, and Cava is an exception as well. Prosecco is an exception. But then when you get into the Southern Hemisphere and into the U.S., we do see that labeling fairly often. I would say probably 80% of the time, if not a bit more.
Now, why do you think that that's been the case where people have gone? I mean, I think méthode champenoise or champagne method is quite elegant. Why do you think people are moving? Are they trying to disassociate from champagne, the region itself and the name?
I think they are. On the flip side, we still have a lot of people that come in asking for champagne. And what they really mean is sparkling wine.
Right.
And so I think that some people are looking for that name, champagne or champenoise. And so, you know, that label helps them identify exactly what it is that they're looking for, because they may not know that if it's not from champagne, it's not technically a true champagne or a grower champagne.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I wonder about starting to use the term more méthode traditionnelle, because I don't know, I think that méthode champenoise, and you can use the English champagne method, that to me would have more selling power because you are 100% correct. People are typically confused when they refer to champagne. They mean the broader family of sparkling wine. So I kind of don't get why it's going that way. I would stick with the champagne method if anybody cared what I think, which is doubtful.
Agreed. And I think that some of the litigation has a little bit to do with that.
Okay.
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, the growing education of wine drinkers and understanding that there is a difference because of where it comes from. And, certainly us, we don't want to make anyone feel like, you know, they're less educated or they don't know something that they're supposed to. That's not our style. But I think some of that bottle labeling, particularly for the U.S., helps people understand just a bit more how that all comes together and how it's properly labeled.
Okay. Yeah. And you guys do a Pearl Wine Company there at 3700 Orleans Avenue in Mid-City in the American Can Building, as I like to say. You guys do a great job with that. There's an educational component. You have an expert staff there. You and I were talking about this the other day, that we're dealing with beverage professionals, not just a register jockey, as we were discussing. We got about a minute left here, Leora, before we have to cut out for the break here and all that stuff, and welcome my rum guests. Tell people about the tasting. So the tasting tonight, Pinot Noir from Willamette, and then sparkling wine made from the Méthode Traditionnelle tomorrow night.
Yes. So tonight we have the education director for Brooks Winery here. Jess is going to be pouring their award-winning Riesling, which of course the latitude is very close with Alsace in Oregon as well. And then she's going to taste us on three different Pinot Noirs from the Willamette Valley. Two that are variable vineyards and then or sourced fruit, and then one that's a single vineyard. So we're really excited to kind of, you know, do that graduation.
And then Leora, tell it real quick, because we got to cut. So to Friday, champagne, 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock, right?
5 to 7 every Thursday and Friday. Tomorrow night we're going to taste Mum, Graham Beck from South Africa, and Sea Smoke from the Central Coast.
Awesome. And these are complimentary tastings, folks. Go check them out. Learn a lot. Taste some good stuff. PearlWineCo.com. Is that correct, Leora?
That's correct.
All right. And you can find them on Facebook. Go check out Leora tonight. Complimentary tasting. Tomorrow night, complimentary tasting. Willamette tonight. Sparkling wine tomorrow night. Folks, come on back to hour number two of the Noel Drinks edition of the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show. WGSO 990 AM New Orleans.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc, a great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Are you looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team-building activities. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in the Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petite Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
With the season's beautiful weather, it's a perfect time to take a drive across Lake Pontchartrain and visit New Orleans' only local vineyard and winery, Pontchartrain Vineyards. Our tasting room is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon till 4, or by appointment. Come enjoy a flight of our wines in our classically styled French Provençal tasting room, or pack a picnic lunch and enjoy a bottle of wine on our patio overlooking the vineyard. While you're there, ask about our wine club. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to hour number two here on NOLA Drinks. Happy to be here with you. This is Brian Diaz. I am your host. Happy Thursday, and it's going to be an even happier second hour. The first hour was really happy, too, but we're just going to keep moving on with the happiness. We have some rum here. We have lots of rum here. I'm looking at lots of rum. And more importantly, I am looking at two very good friends, Conrad Cantor of El Libre and Alex Anderson of Cane and Table, the birthday girl. Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for taking time out on your birthday to come in and be on the show.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. So, Alex, you're over there at Cane and Table. We talked about that's 1100 block of Decatur, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, cool. And you're behind the bar there, as we were noting at the top of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bartender.
Bartender. Bartender, bartender extraordinaire. How long have you been there at Cane and Table?
A little bit over 2 years now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. And where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Atlanta.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what brought you down to New Orleans? I know this story, but the listeners don't.
So it's mostly the bar scene. Being in Atlanta, it was an interesting scene, and like there were a lot of things going on, but I kind of felt like I wanted to expand and see what I could do in another city. So I came down here and got my job at Cane & Table, and it's been great ever since. My old boss hooked me up with this job, and I was super excited to be in like the Cure company, because Cane & Table, Cure, and Cafe Henri are all part of the same conglomerate. And it's been a really wonderful journey ever since then.
Awesome. And I should mention, this is our At the Bar segment, where it's kind of a round table of bartenders and others connected to the drink and food industry here in New Orleans, or maybe sometime down the road beyond. So that's what we're doing here today. And also joining us is Conrad Cantor from El Libre.
How you doing, Brian?
Good, buddy. Good to see you, man. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Excellent. Excellent. I hadn't seen you for a long time, and then I bumped into you at the aforementioned Cane and Table about 2 weeks ago. That was the first time in a while. You'd been traveling, man.
Yes. Went over to Ireland and Germany. Ireland for the first time. I did live in Germany for a couple years, so it's always nice to find an excuse to spend a couple nights over there when I'm in Europe.
Did you go back to where you used to live? Or
I didn't, actually. I'm pretty familiar with Cologne, but I wanted to take Basil to see Cologne. So I never actually lived there. I lived more in the north, more in Hamburg.
Okay. Okay. And you mentioned Basil Zerinsky, she is your significant other, also fine bartender here in New Orleans.
Yes.
And she's been on the show and will be again. So, but she had to work.
She is working. She's a workaholic.
She is a workaholic.
Yeah. Someone's got to pay the bills while I'm here in the radio station.
Slacking off
rum.
Drinking rum. Exactly. Awesome. I'm glad you're here slacking off drinking rum. So you're over there at, you're the co-proprietor of El Libre on Domain and Decatur.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So a year? A little bit over a year, right?
Over a year. Construction on the 500 block.
The never-ending construction.
Yeah, that's a good way to mark how long we've been open. It's pretty much simultaneous with the construction.
Excellent timing, man.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent timing and opening up an establishment there in the quarter. So it's a cool place. It's Cuban themed, so it's a Cuban cafe. So you guys do coffee, you guys do Cuban sandwiches, and then there is an emphasis on, for the most part, Cuban cocktails, correct?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Please don't call me, sir. You know me far. Okay, thank you. I appreciate you being polite. You're making me nervous, man. I've known you for too long for you to call me sir. So, Conrad, before we get into these other topics, so I know where you're from, but tell everybody else where you're from.
I am from South Florida, originally the island of Palm Beach. I've lived in New Orleans for about 13 years. Spent additional time as a kid, actually, in the summer. I spent from when I was 14 through 18 before I came here for college. I spent about a month every summer working in construction in the French Quarter, learning how to do just kind of basic stuff. So definitely feel like a New Orleans native, but I can't answer that where'd you go to high school question.
Yeah. So, the common so word.
I say that I'm from Florida. I really feel a little more at home here, but I guess both places at this point are home.
Gotcha. That makes all the sense in the world. That definitely. Now, when you went to Germany, was that when you were a kid? Like, was your dad in the military?
No, actually, no. Father's an orthopedic surgeon. I went on my own. Katrina affected my studies here, actually, at Tulane. And it was 2006, 2008, and I was actually just doing more community service type work. I was working with families and stuff like that. So it was 2 years learning a culture and a language that I hadn't been raised with. But at the same time, I was not focusing as much on myself, more kind of focusing on other people and just taking a break from the American everyday life.
So, that makes all the sense in the world too. Cool. Good experience to go abroad.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Now, Alex, when you were in Atlanta then, so did you start your bartending career in Georgia? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So I started at the Lawrence in Atlanta, and Eric Simpkins was my mentor there. And, he was originally like got all of his training in New York, and he came down to Atlanta to change the restaurant scene and bar scene in Atlanta. And then he passed that knowledge onto his bartenders. So it was really awesome because he's very, very highly qualified, and he taught me a lot in like 2 years that I was working with him. So
and so you were there for a couple years and being tutored, if you will, and learning and then that kind of thing. And then you. Had you been to New Orleans before when you came here and visited the cocktail scene and all that?
I visited one time.
Okay.
I came down with a group of girls and we all, like, you know, it was kind of funny because I came down with, like, you know, about 9 girls and 5 of them wanted to hang out on Bourbon Street the entire time. And 4 of us were like, no.
Was this a bachelorette party?
It was not. No,
okay, it wasn't
just,
quite.
It was like kind of a birthday party thing, but we were all about 23. So it was just a young girl's like, oh, let's go to New Orleans. But I actually still have the list of cocktail bars I wanted to go to when I first visited New Orleans when I was 23 years old. And it's like, Cure. Bartonique and all these parts are still here. That's still such great influence. And I'm really happy to be like involved in this scene.
Yeah,
like,
for sure. And yeah.
Incredible.
Awesome. And you guys are both well ensconced here in the scene at both of your places. And I think that's really neat because, you know, you mentioned Cure, arguably the original new generation, I'll say, craft cocktail bar in New Orleans. We always have this conversation on the show because one can argue that they're craft cocktails, so-called craft cocktails, have gone on in this city for quite some time,
going back
to the 19th century. But what we're going to talk about today, you guys, and we've got a couple minutes here, so let's just kind of tee it up, and then we'll take a break and get into what we're going to talk about. Want to talk about proto-tiki, tiki, Cuban drinks. There's obviously this sort of nice tie-in with a lot of this stuff. Certainly rum as the base spirit, I think, can be connected to this, not necessarily always, but we're talking about, you know, Caribbean stuff, and I know the tiki tradition sort of pulls in from a mythological view that brings in the Pacific and some things like that. But that's what we're going to get into here after this break. And let's go ahead, and if you guys are good with this, let's go ahead and take the break now. Anthony, you good with that? Anthony had to go deal with his car. You still have a car? Didn't get towed? All right, good. Good to hear Anthony still has transportation. So we're going to take a quick break here on the Nola Drink Show. We're going to be right back, and we're going to get into some rum.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Little Irma Thomas, come on back.
Springtime in New Orleans is beckoning us back on our front porches, favorite patio bars, and restaurants. Dickie Brennan's Tableau offers some of the best outdoor dining in the French Quarter. Soak in the beautiful weather on the balcony overlooking Jackson Square or by the whispering fountain in the cozy courtyard. Tableau also offers an amazing happy hour from 2 to 6 p.m. every day of the week, offering half-price beer and wine on tap, $5 classic cocktails, and discounted small plates. For menus, reservations, and more, visit TableauFrenchQuarter.com. Tableau is located at 616 St. Peter Street.
Hey, ladies. Are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello Wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to Nola Drinks here on WGSO 990 AM New Orleans. A little bit of the meters. Friends, highway robbery. I'm going to say this right now. The meters once again left off the ballot of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for 2017. That's a crime. I don't know. We're talking about rum here, stuff like that. Can you guys believe that the meters got left off the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ballot? This is like the third year in a row.
That's crazy.
Crazy.
Yeah.
It's crime. I'm not happy about it. I was actually listening to WWOZ was in the middle of their pledge drive yesterday, and the couple DJs that were on were saying people from Cleveland, I'm questioning why the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is in Cleveland anyway, but people from Cleveland should call in and pledge double because of what's gone on with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the meters. And you guys are nodding. I know we're not even meant to talk about that, but I just can't believe, I can't believe that.
Isn't there like Chubby Checker thing too, right? Didn't he get, like, he's never won anything?
I'm not sure, but that wouldn't surprise me. I think there seems to be sort of, I think like, I don't know if there's some sort of bias against like New Orleans funk music and stuff like that. I mean, there's some really cool people that were nominated. So, you know, like I'm not a big prog rock guy, but like ELO is on the ballot, and Tupac Shakur is obviously, you know, a groundbreaker in hip hop. You know, I wonder
he's
about
not in there yet though. That's surprising.
No, you know, because like there's something about, I think you have to have had your first album had to have been made no less than 20 years before. It's something along those lines. And so, you know, a lot more of the hip hop artists are starting to, you know, meet that bar. And then also Bad Brains, you know, which is a quintessential punk and political band.
Very important
band.
First all black hardcore band.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, and so I'm not knocking any of these, but man, the meters. Mm. Anyway, I'm going to get off my soapbox. Let's talk a little bit about rum here. So we are enjoying, friends, some nice things in honor, of course, of Alex's birthday. And I should say I'm joined by Alex Anderson from Cane and Table, birthday girl.
Yay.
Hey. And Conrad Cantor from El Libre. Happy unbirthday to you, Conrad.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so we're actually tasting a little bit of Havana Club, the Añejo Reserva rum, which I actually brought in for Alex. This is for you, Alex.
Yay.
Yeah. And so this is a Cuban rum, and it's basically not available at this point, although I think these things may be changing from Cuba, and you can't get it in the States these days. So this came from all legal, came from duty free somewhere. But that's a nice little segue. So let's talk a little bit about Cuban cocktails. And I'll start with you, Conrad, because the theme of El Libre is based on that. And then we'll have you jump in, Alex, because we were talking about some of the new menus on the drink are inspired by the era of the Cuban Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So, Conrad, talk a little bit about what are some of these classic Cuban cocktails, and you know, what does that mean to your program, and just, you know, kind of some of the impetus of that.
I think, like, if we could rewind from just actual cocktails and go a little bit into the cantineros, like basically the Cuban bartenders were the first group of bartenders to ever establish any guild, which is very important to us at El Libre. And it should be for every bartender, because Bartenders Guild, the first outside of Cuba, the UKBG, United Kingdom Bartenders Guild, was, a lot of people cite that as the first, but the Cantineros of Cuba actually, they had a system in place to ensure, it wasn't like a union, but it almost kind of was. They made sure they had, health benefits and gym memberships and all kinds of stuff like this. So
when did this start, roughly?
This was in the 18. I wish I could tell you the exact year.
Okay.
We can
look it up too.
Yeah. I would say early to mid 1800s.
Okay.
But that's just a guess.
Okay.
But it does predate the UKBG. So anyway, you had this organization of bartenders that really took their job seriously, and they were considered, it was a career. And a lot of parts of the world, bartending is still not quite seen as a career. So what we really try to focus on at El Libre is reestablishing the fact that career bartending is actually something to indeed. To aspire to.
Indeed. And actually, thank you for saying that, Connor. We talk a lot, and I know you guys have heard, other folks on the show that are some of your colleagues and peers. We talk a lot about that on this show, that especially, here in this town too, at Cane and Table, where you are, Alex, as well, that this, it is a career, it is a profession, it's a trade, it's a craft, it's all of these things. And, we've had different conversations about when people ask, what do you want to be when you grow up? And that's an offensive question. It can be. And I mean, certainly, look, we know that a lot of people work in the service industry and they're working their way through school, and that's a great thing. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that just because that's everybody's reality here. And so getting back to, let's jump over to you also. We're talking a little bit about traditional Cuban cocktails, and we'll come back. We'll rewind a little bit further before cocktails and, the proto stuff. But you guys are doing some stuff now, fast forwarding to I'm going to assume the 50s, late 50s, early 60s, sort of Cuban Revolution inspired stuff.
Well,
and if you want to rewind.
Yeah, I was going to say, the things that we're doing now at Cane Table are actually American Revolution inspired.
Oh, Americans, I'm sorry. I took that to mean Cuban Revolution.
Yeah, bunch of Americans that were drinking a whole bunch of rum for many, many years.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
American Revolution had more to do with rum than it did with tea.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, rum and porter beer, and that was kind of like, that was the jam. That was everybody was drinking that. But if you want to go back to Cuban cocktails,
Alex, actually, let's go ahead and we'll look chronological here.
Okay.
Since that's kind of our earliest
point. Now we're going way back.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and start there, and then we'll kind of migrate forward, as it were. So yeah, talk a little bit about what... So people were drinking rum and people were drinking porter beer.
Yeah.
And then we started to see things like punches and stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, punches were always kind of integrated in taverns. Like that was kind of the thing that was just always there. And that's kind of the whole reason why a lot of you see restaurants popping up with having a punch theme these days. Because mm-hmm. that dates back to historical cocktail events and having this one item of citrus and spirit and whatever and serving that to guests, and that's kind of very social in how it was developed. And but with rum and Madeira and sherry and porter beer, those are all really integrated in with our founding fathers. Jefferson has a whole list of Madeiras that he loved, mm-hmm. and you can even go back to Portugal and order the same Madeira that he drank.
Oh, right. Interesting. Okay.
Lots of money, but you can still try this beverage that was his favorite. And George Washington was a big purveyor of Jamaican rum. Mm-hmm. And that was his personal favorite, along with he would drink a lot of hot ciders and stuff like that during the Revolution.
And so these were hot ciders that were with rum, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, and I know that, for example, a lot of these early White House parties, Andrew Jackson springs to mind. I know we're talking a little bit after the Revolution, of course, but punches in some of these things, rums, beer, these are all very commonly served, of course. I think less wine, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, wine was hard to come by in the United States because we couldn't grow grapes really well. So it was easier to have ciders. Because we had obviously a lot of apples in the United States, and then it was easier to have rum because that was right there at the Caribbean. That's not that far away.
Exactly.
And Madeira grew in so much popularity over here. It actually wasn't that popular in Europe because Madeira was kind of not ripe enough when it would go to European countries, but by the time it crossed the Atlantic and stuff and had that time to cook in the barrels and things, that's when it would develop its really rich flavor.
And it would actually preserve on ships,
mm-hmm.
right? And obviously wine would often fail. Yeah. Wine brought over from Europe would fail because there was no air conditioning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a really, the way that the American palate developed was a little bit more different from how the European palate was.
Okay.
And we try to, like, keep...
So you're saying it's sort of inspired by, but not necessarily entirely... ingredients were more limited then, right? We didn't have the same breadth of products and other things that we can bring to the table.
I mean, we didn't have
ice. We weren't even using ice.
Yeah.
We weren't even using ice.
Correct.
Exactly. So, I mean, and some of that's got to be, it's got to be made palatable. I want ice.
Yeah.
So, and we can get ice now, so we might as well avail ourselves of that. So you guys are taking the inspiration then from some of these things that were the basis, I'm going to guess then, of drinks from this time.
We are. Right now we're working on a menu that is very much so inspired by revolutionary cocktails, but we are putting our own like spin and take on it. Some of us are trying to we're trying to do things more traditional, but we're also trying to bring it into the new era. So it's kind of an interesting process. It's like trying to see what works and what doesn't with like modern tastes, and that's always what it is. It's bringing older cocktails into the modern era.
Gotcha. Well, here's, you guys, we're going to take we'll come back to this. We'll fast forward a little bit, and then we'll go to some of the pre-cocktail, we'll go to cumin stuff, talk proto tiki here after the break. We're gonna drink more rum.
Yeah.
Sweet.
All right, cool. Folks, coming back to the last half an hour here of the NOLA Drink Show, Dine Wine and Spirits, Brian Diaz, WGSO 990 AM New Orleans.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey. The way New Orleans does whiskey.
This is Christopher Icaza, general manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucaray. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's Grand Dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon dining room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in the Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
The French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon of St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Rum is the chosen spirit of Palace Cafe's Black Duck Bar and features an extensive rum collection from all over the world. Be sure to join us for happy hour Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m., with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine. Look forward to seeing you soon at Palace Cafe's new Black Duck Bar.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show, Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, all that good stuff. WTSO 990 AM New Orleans. This is Brian Diaz, and I am here with Conrad Cantor of El Libre and Alex Anderson of Cane and Table, two great bars and establishments, restaurants as well, in the French Quarter. And we were talking a little bit about, with Alex over there at Cane and Table doing American Revolution. I thought we were talking about Cuban. We're talking about American Revolution inspired cocktails. And Conrad, you just poured us during the break something that you're coming up with. We're going to go back to that time again briefly, a Ben Franklin recipe.
Yeah, this is actually from 1750. It's written down in the Library of Congress, but it's Ben Franklin's orange shrub.
Okay.
And this is something I just happened to be transporting to work on at Cane and Table because it's going to hopefully find its place on the new Cane and Table menu.
Yeah,
which by the way, I'm there two nights a week.
Just going to
say. Alex is actually my mentor. And
How's that working out for you, Alex?
It's great.
Cracking the whip, man.
Yeah, she's beat me up. But it's funny because someone recently said, well, what do you want to go? You're doing your own thing. Why do you want to go back to like being an apprentice for, you know, and there's always so much to learn. And I've had now two wonderful women. Abigail obviously was my cocktail mom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now Alex and Basil, you could say, is even a third mentor. So I'm really just like a little boy being told what to do by all these awesome women, and it's great.
That's awesome. Three great professionals. You're no doubt about it.
So this is slightly modified, like you said, optimized is a better word to fit the modern palate. Needs a little bit of work. Need to incorporate some baking spices into there, but I think that the first cocktail I ever had at Cane and Table was the improved Bombo. And George Washington used to drink Bombos, and they're basically just using products that didn't exist at that time.
What is a Bombo?
The Bombo is really, it's got Jamaican rum and molasses was like a original Bombo with nutmeg. It was obviously very warm the way they would drink it.
Mm-hmm.
At Cane and Table, they add a little bit of the Pierre Franz dry Curacao.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a little more selective with the type of rums. There's a marriage of rums in there, still the Jamaican kind of English style, but it's just a little more carefully put together, just to fit the modern palate. So,
okay.
So that was, you know, really my introduction to proto tiki as a customer's perspective.
Okay. And let's go there. And Alex, to you, cause we were talking about this also during the break. So we've basically gone from the 18th century here, American Revolution, Ben Franklin, that kind of thing. And this starts to inform what we're now calling the proto-tiki movement. We'll get to the tiki movement, early 30s. So we start to have these ingredients. We start to have these approaches. We start to add other things, right, to these beverages that start to come closer to what we would call the contemporary cocktail, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so where did we go, you know, say, maybe pick a point, you know, in the 19th century, obviously, where do we go from there to through before 1933 with the tiki movement?
It probably was like about the late 1800s with like the Savoy cocktail book and stuff like that, when mm-hmm. we had these bartenders that spent some time kind of around the world, and they started making their own cocktail books. And there is a lot of really great influence from bartenders from Germany and from England and from New York, like a lot of them spent some time in Cuba, and like a lot of that had a lot of the influence of building up bigger like cocktail scenes in that region. And a lot of them like fled there actually during the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
So like a lot of bartenders from New York went there.
Okay, now did this and I'm assuming that this informed ingredients and then created a demand, but we started to get into more modern shipping methods, obviously being able to get things from the Caribbean and South America. So things like citrus became much more widely used, I'm guessing. So people are exploring and then they're discovering new ingredients. And then I'm guessing finding mechanisms to actually access these ingredients. Does that sound right? Or
yeah, definitely is. Cause like definitely it helped with the development of cocktails. Like citrus wasn't used as much in cocktails until much later mm-hmm. in the game.
You couldn't get it really. I mean, other than,
yeah, but it was only used in punches.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. More like the oils, like
the essences and stuff like that. Right. And yeah, I mean, like oranges okay.
A single serving of a citrus cocktail just didn't happen
mm-hmm.
for many years. What did we say was the first really cocktail?
The first cocktail? Well, the old fat was 1806. Citrus. Oh, the first, really, I mean, I would say going back to Savoy, I'm sure Crusta really would have been.
Yeah, that's right.
The direct.
Get right up there, man. Straight in the mic.
Really going back to Savoy, I think, where you had this plethora of like what we call improved sours, where you had drinks like the Aviation and stuff. Like
right, that. Right. And I think, you know, there's some debate, you know, Wondrich in his book talks a little bit about the term cocktail and really seems to actually now go back to the, you know, the late 18th century
mm-hmm.
Involving ginger and ginger being used with a spirit. And I believe sugar, perhaps. I'm not 100% clear on that. And the term maybe comes from the idea, you guys probably know this, that people that would show horses would put a piece of ginger up the backside of the horse so it would raise its tail.
Yeah, we just talked about that actually at work. Yep.
And there, that you know, and what he's wondered and others have gone through and done is gone back and researched mentions now that a lot of newspapers and periodicals have been digitized, can search for terms and these sorts of things. And so he's come up with a reference to something alluding to a cocktail and a beverage in the UK in the late 18th century.
Yeah, I think it was either late 18th century or 1804.
Well, that was found. That was
1806
known.
Was when the cocktail was established as like this is what
that was first printed.
Right,
first
print. Well,
I think 1804.
Right, and this actually he's found something that goes back to the late 18th century, really? Like 1796 or something along those lines. Yeah. And I mean, it kind of morphed, and I forget the exact quote that he found, but it was something along the lines that, you know, was referring to the ginger and, you know, and then something having a beverage and, you know, you'll be walking around with your tail cocked, referring to being kind of drunk, I think. And so that's kind of the, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just a vernacular term that's going to morph. But anyway, you know, moving forward from that, didn't want to get off track to that. That'll be a topic for another show, y'all.
Mm-hmm.
So moving forward to what we're now kind of coining retroactively as the proto tiki movement. What do we start to see change in these drinks? We've talked about citrus. What is fundamentally going to be seen as different moving in forward that way through the 19th century and early 20th?
True tiki, or
well, even through from these older cocktails into proto tiki. I mean, what would we call? What would maybe be the main three or four things in what we would call a proto tiki drink these days? The pre 1930s cocktails.
I mean, I would think that like the establishment of having like a different kind of like fruit base, like doing that like passion fruit kind of aspect to it.
So syrups,
yeah, definitely like the syrups. Like because it's kind of difficult to say exactly what was the major influencers because with tiki, the first tiki movement was so secretive.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely involved a lot of fresh juices. Using fresh lime, fresh lemon, fresh pineapple. That was like an essential part of like the tiki movement and proto tiki, I guess. And it was like, and also using like different varietals of rum, like using the kind of like agricole rum style and a Jamaican rum and all these different kind of Puerto Rican rums definitely changed how tiki like came in development, because a lot of it was like had to be cost effective as well for these guys,
right,
when they were first starting.
So we kind of had then maybe a meeting of the worlds, if you will, where we had, you know, a lot of rum going on in this country and mm-hmm. kind of coming that from that punch in another avenue, and then a lot of the cocktails using that term, where we had a base spirit, bitters, and sugar or syrup, you know, as it eventually became, that more often than not was either cognac or whiskey driven, correct?
Yeah, that was later. Because like at first, like America was drinking mostly rum until about the mid-1700s. And mm-hmm. then, of course, we started to rebel against the English. That was our rum import. So once we started to rebel, we went to our own sources. And that was going to be rye whiskey and bourbon.
Okay.
And so it kind of felt like rum kind of like fell off the face of the earth for a little bit, like at least for America. We were still drinking it, but not as much historically. And then all the like anti-alcohol movements started to happen, and that like kind of like killed everything for some time.
In prohibition, of course. And then let's do this, you guys. Let's take a break now, and then we're going to come back, because we've sort of covered the proto tiki world, how we've gone from the late 18th century through the 19th century, and then we're going to come up on 1933, which is the advent of tiki. And we come out of prohibition, and we get fruit juices and Trader Vic's and Mai Tais and all this good stuff. So, folks, coming back to the Noel Drink Show here on WGSO 990 AM New Orleans. We'll be right back.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Breakfast is new to the menu at Dickie Brennan's Tableau. Stop by for Tableau's signature Eggs Benedict or order their famous bread pudding pan perdu. Tableau now offers brass brunch on Saturdays and Sundays beginning at 10 a.m. Listen to the rhythmic sounds of a New Orleans-style brass band while enjoying a wonderful brunch in the heart of the French Quarter overlooking historic Jackson Square. For menus, reservations, and more, visit TableauFrenchQuarter.com or call 504-934-3463. Tableau is located at 616 St. Peter Street.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for joining us today. So you guys, we're here with Conrad Cantor from El Libre and Alex Anderson from Cane and Table. We've kind of been a little bit all over the place, admittedly, but now we've moved ourselves up, hopefully, if you followed us, might be a trick, to 1933, and we're coming out of Prohibition here in the U.S., and we get the Tiki movement. And how does this all happen?
Yeah, so the Tiki movement started with Don Beachcomber, who actually changed his name legally to Don Beachcomber. His name originally was, I can look it up right now.
So did he actually, include the definite article, Don the Beachcomber? Was the middle name, or is it just Don Beachcomber?
It was just Don Beachcomber. Okay. So yeah, his original name was Ernest Raymond Beaumont Gant.
Yeah, Don Beachcomber sounds a lot better. That's easier to remember.
He was self-funded. He traveled around the Caribbean, and then he got back to the United States and opened up a bar in Hollywood in 1933 called Don the Beachcombers, mm-hmm. and started the Tiki movement.
Now, we were talking, Alex, a little bit before, and we mentioned this, and we were talking about this in parts during the break, that it's based on some things. There was a romantic notion of people gallivanting around the Pacific, like we were talking about Errol Flynn and some of these things. Mm-hmm. Of course, Hemingway had some influence, I think, on this. but really, this is a mythological world that's being created, correct?
Yeah, it definitely is. I think that with the Beachcomber kind of, I guess, brand, they stayed more a little bit more Caribbean inspired, but it was the next year when the Trader Vic's inspired restaurants opened in 1934, which wasn't called Trader Vic's at the time, but he later, like 6 years later, he changed it to the name Trader Vic's. And that's where like the crazy Asian and Polynesian influence came from.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the whole like mythical kind of fantasy of like building this brand of like kind of, you know, bamboo and tiki and fire and
totemistic statues and things
like
that.
Different
right.
things.
But on an ingredient level, and maybe Connor, you want to jump in here on an ingredient level then, but we are seeing then stuff start to come from the Pacific, right? We're seeing like pineapple being used, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're marrying pineapple with rum.
Is that the food as well too, I think is a big part of tiki. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's very, you could say Asian. Almost. There's a lot of French Polynesian.
Right.
As you said, I think it was over the break you said it, but they were just doing Chinese food almost.
Yeah, and when you said we were talking about Cantonese food, and we were talking about like all the way out in Singapore, for example, that had some of these influences from both Europe and Asia and those things being met. And you said something during the break that about sort of the view that was being created and the sort of stereotypical, maybe that's not the right word to use, of what we thought French Polynesia was like.
It was
really
like a romanticized, uneducated view of what it was.
We're seeing this in films also, you know, like we were talking about a lot of these movies and these pirate movies and some of these things became and sailing movies and exploring the Indo-Pacific and stuff was very popular. Yeah. Errol Flynn, I mean, it's sort of what we're talking about there.
I mean, I think it's interesting because like the tiki movement at that time, like it just, and to continue for many, many years, the tiki bars that you would experience were always like really dark and like very, like there would be no windows. And that was kind of the, something that Don the Beachcomber would do, would he would keep people in his bar purposely by making it sound like there was rain happening because there were no windows. You had no idea what was going on. So he'd make it sound like it was raining if people started to leave. And then they'd be like, oh, I'm going to hang out for another drink or so. So they had little tricks and little fun things that they would do.
It's a lot of those casino tricks.
Yeah,
exactly.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's probably where they started. Almost.
Yeah, I think you're right. Las Vegas was just right there. Yeah, exactly. No clocks, pumping oxygen in there. You probably didn't do that. And that's interesting that you mentioned that, Alex, because of course we know from a certain standpoint, when I want to think tiki and tropical, I'm thinking my feet in the sand, sitting on a bar stool in an outdoor thatched roof, kind of situation.
Yeah, that's like that, and like they would recreate that in their bars. They would have like the bamboo and thatch roof and all those kind of like dark wood and everything to influence like your whole tiki experience with minus the sand floors, of course, but
right.
It would be kind of loungy and it would be a different kind of vibe than you get in modern bars these days. And it's really kind of interesting if you look at it.
Yeah. And you do. And you find, I know like in California, there are most of these places are new, but some that have been around for decades. The hometown that I grew up in the East Bay, south of Oakland, there was a bar that was called something Polynesia. It was a tiny little shoebox bar, but they had two Polynesian totems statues out front. This was established in the 60s and went on through this. It was a Hell's Angels bar, by the way, which is very interesting.
Nice.
But so then, Connor, talk a little bit about Cuban cocktails then. So now... we're kind of maybe backing up a little bit, but some of the stuff
that's
happening.
It's not really like back or forward. I think there's a movement coexisting.
Okay.
It's a good way to put it. Around the same time. I would say that it's important to look at rum from a macro perspective, that it really has less rules than any spirit. And I think that it really, if you look at the American Revolution, if you look at just American culture in general, it parallels rum. The Wayne Curtis's book And a Bottle of Rum is a great kind of demonstrates, you know, how from a very historically accurate perspective. But you have this spirit that really doesn't, other than agricole, right, which has to be from the actual cane juice, there's just not a whole lot of rules around.
So you can
rum,
you can add molasses, you can add sugar, yeah, you can add color, you can add water, right?
Correct. And so with tiki, you had kind of just this anything goes as far as the actual makeup of the genetic makeup of the drinks, right? But then with the Cuban cocktails, there were a little more, I guess, at the same time as the tiki, there was a little more finesse with a lot of the Cuban drinks. I think that goes back to the conversation we started at the beginning of the hour about how serious the cantineros, which means bartenders,
right,
were about their recipes. You know, if you wanted to be a member of the guild, you had to memorize up to 75 drinks,
wow,
to make for customers. And this was as early as the 1800s. So I think that although rum was the primary spirit used in a lot of the classic Cuban cocktails we know today, there was the parameters were a little more refined for the Cuban drinks.
So,
and still are.
And as I think you guys, so I was like, tiki, we're talking about kind of, as you said, became a free-for-all. So we're putting, and you know, fruit juice is pretty sweet stuff, right? Often.
Well, tiki was super secretive. With Trader Vic and Don the Peachcomber, they did not release their recipes like at all.
Mm-hmm.
So their bartenders did not know what they were pouring.
So they were batched for
them.
They
were batched for the bartenders, and they had no idea what they were pouring. Like, only it was a very secretive small group that knew what they were. So it's only in recent history that we've actually had these cocktails come in to light, like the Mai Tai and the Zombie. Nobody knew exactly what those recipes were until more recently.
People kind of deconstruct them or found records, and these things came out. Or people, right? Okay, gotcha. Well, you guys, do me a favor. We will revisit these topics because we can obviously unpack any one of these eras. So we'll do this again very soon. But we've got about a minute or so left. Conrad, tell people where they can real quick find you, both online and physically there at El Libre.
So with El Libre right now, what I'm doing, we've actually just hired three new people.
Okay.
That are awesome. They're bright, shining stars, and they're in the process of learning about our very minimal drink program, but very historically, relevant drink program as far as the Cuban era goes.
So your address, so, and people come
508 Dumain.
Yep.
The street that's completely torn up still.
Sidewalks there.
Yeah. About 13 months now. No, we don't have a sidewalk now. Or by the end of the week, we won't. Maybe after Halloween, they'll replace us with a sidewalk.
Cool.
So there, and then I'm bartending at Cane and Table on Fridays.
Which Alex is where?
Yeah, I'm at Cane and Table Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday.
1100 block of Decatur?
Yep, 1113 Decatur. And then I'm also at Cura on Thursdays.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
Conrad, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it, buddy.
Thanks for having
me. Alex, thank you. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing. Folks, come on back to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits show tomorrow. I'll be filling in for Tim. I'll be back next week, as I mentioned, with Roddy Romero from Roddy Romero and the Hub City All-Stars and some other folks. And, I hope everybody have a great Thursday evening. Go drink some rum, huh? And until then, cheers, y'all.